Yes, good morning to you, and thank you very much for putting in your submission, which we've had a good read of, but we'd very much welcome if you could highlight your key points for us.
Yep, sure thing. Great. Okay. So yeah, thank you for the invitation to speak to my submission. So I'll briefly go through my points, and there's probably one key point I want to make at the end, which I'll probably touch on as I go through.
We've got plenty of time, so don't feel rushed.
Okay, cool. So I'm pleased I actually was in the audience listening to some of those, because I've sort of helped away some of my comments. And firstly, the Rule 23, which is intensive winter grazing rule, I guess I have a real issue with the area with methodology, which is the 20 or 50 hectare thing, depending on what zone or catchment you're in. I guess my suggestion would be that you look at the system or the stocking rate or the economic viability, for example, self-containment, all those sort of things, rather than putting just a configure in. Now, I understand that possibly it's put there to trigger maybe applying for a consent, and I understand that.
Yeah.
But I guess the loophole I see in that is that, in fact, and we've been an example of this, is that you could have a town, someone on this farms that call it a farmlet on the side of the town that might graze all of his little farmlet in it, and get a farmer from the outside to do that. In fact, I've been involved in a business that a farming operation has done exactly that, and wintered half their cows on the total area, which is about 11 hectares, just on the outside skirts. So I see that as a, you know, someone's going to look at breaking those rules anyway, and I'm very to be vulnerable, and I didn't do that to exploit it because it was done beforehand. But those things that could happen. But the other thing is that really, if that puts into place, although the consenting process is there, that it could have a far-reaching effect on the community, not just on the businesses involved, but the people that work for them. We've got some large operations in our area that do large winter grazing operations, and there's lots of families that can have ongoing, far-reaching effects on local schools and communities as well. Mm-hmm. The physiographic mapping zone that Tony has just touched on also helps to validate what I'm going to say. That I understand that it's not validated. I haven't done any research to find that out. I've just been, it's been talked to me about that it's not validated information. So I'm really, I don't oppose that being used as guidelines, but I do have, I'm very, very concerned with using it in a rule-based type situation. For example, where Tony, in his situation, had 10% of his farm in the map and said that it had more, it could be actually the opposite. Could have been on other properties where he might have half his farm 10% on the map saying, but...
It could cut either way.
Exactly, so then we're actually having a detrimental effect on the environment, which is not what we're about either. So Rule 25, which is the cultivation of sloping grounds, I've been involved in all sorts of types of topography and catchments in my farming operation, and had experience in this, and if the rules were in place now, I would have broken many rules back in the day when I developed my land, and I've learned from those. But I guess I have no issue with the cultivation above 700 metres not being done, but I do have an issue with the sloping ground, and that Not as far as the sloping ground goes, but every farm is different, and depends on whether there's a creek or waterway at the bottom of that slope, or 500 metres away, or whether some of the paddock is 20 degrees or less or more. And so I guess when you throw a blanket rule over Southland, and we all know how diverse Southland is, I think that's a real dangerous thing to do. And again, it sort of goes back to my initial point where you get yourself and you find loopholes and so forth. And the approach that I'd advise you to consider was around that, is around having a management plan and actually having someone come in and look at the property, and I'll touch on that a bit more in a second, because that's probably what I want to finish on. Just a small point with regard to policy 9 in the old Matera type soil, which is the area that we reside in. Even though I don't know that I have any on my property, the wording strongly discourages the granting of consent, so I just find that quite emotive in the wording of it. So just a small point, I wonder whether you could change the wording so it doesn't bring the emotion and we just focus on the facts over there. Because as you can sense the some of the emotion and some of the farmers that you would have seen already coming through the door.
Yeah.
Policy 17, which is avoiding, I support the effluent policy to the point where I actually think that avoiding any effluent in waterways is actually not strong enough. I think it should be prohibited. We don't want any effluent in the waterways, so actually to say that it's sort of okay to do it once in a while, I think that's wrong, because we need to actually make a stronger stance on keeping effluent out of our waterways. And my final point, which is around the management plan requirements, I believe that a management plan, I guess, is a far more educational way, more carrot than a stick approach. It actually, you'll find that Environment South and staff will probably, after a while, get alongside with farmers rather than having that opposing view. And you've always had these comments. I do make the comment that Environment South and have really upped their game in the last few years, as opposed to what it used to be like a number of years ago, and really want to. It's been really encouraging, but I think this can actually help further that. And the reason I say that is I've just, without going through it, these two focus plans I've had done, and one for our dairy farm, one for a runoff, which we lease. I went through this process with one of the guys at staff here, Carl Erickson, and I found it really educational. He was on board. We went around our farm, came back, we had a good meeting around all the things he thought we could improve on, whether it's fencing off areas, plantation, some of the things that I thought were maybe marginal, he actually thought were good practice. So, you know, that was an education in itself. But what you're doing is you're actually specifically giving a management plan to your farm, not a blanket approach. And I guess I'm a real fan of collaborative approach, not put rules in place and police them. I think that would help our communities if Environment South will take more of that approach and educate our farmers around some of that stuff. And actually, you'll find that the farmers will educate the staff as well around farming practices in practical sense. So that's probably my bit.
Excellent. See if we have questions for you, Maurice. Just come at your end.
Thank you. Thanks, Dylan. That's very helpful. I've got a couple here. You say 15% of your farm for winter grazing without having to get a resource consent. Why do you choose 15?
Did I say 15%?
Did you think that I put rule 23 in your original submission?
Okay. Our accounts. What then?
No.
It would be dangerous for me to put a figure on it. I think, but I can speak to that. Anyway, with regard to that, so a percentage of when you're looking at farming systems, typically in a dairy farm situation, most farmers would probably, in good practice, regrass 10% of the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's the sort of thing I'd be looking at as far as, what makes your system work and how can we adapt that to make sure that we mitigate issues environmentally on the places.
Okay, so 10% is a rough guide.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, that's only in our farm. It's chicken beef, I can't speak of, because I've got some huge, big farms, and that would be, you know, an excessive amount of land as well to be taken out. So maybe it's not appropriate for the type of topography there.
Well, it's just a trigger between permitted activity and having to get a resource consent anyway.
Yes.
So you can still do it over there.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
And you also commented towards the end of your submission about overseer. And you say, is that right?
No, I didn't. Anyway, I can answer the question if you want.
No, you didn't submit on it, so you
all right.
No, I didn't submit on it.
Okay. No, that's all then.
Okay. Good morning. Now, just what sort of intensive winter grazing, how do you manage your operation in terms of...
That's a good question. Presently, we're farming on fodder beet, wintering on fodder beet, and percentage-wise, on our home dairy farm, I think we put into crop at about 5%, and on our runoff would be closer to 10%, probably percent. However, what I didn't lead just helps me lead on to something else. Through this focus plan, we formed a relationship with Carl Erickson, and he invited me to maybe look at doing some trial work with regard to nitrogen, mitigating nitrogen. So we actually put in a crop of oats and milata this year and did some more grass wintering on some bonier country, which is tailings, and to see how that would work practically. And their idea was to, they've done the trial work up in Canterbury where they planted oats, and is to take up the nitrogen because it emerges and strikes early, and I deem it to be quite successful. However, looking at the cost of it, we may be changing things a little bit, but what it's led to is now looking at our farm practice to actually doing all 100% of our wintering in all grass on the appropriate land top, and I believe that will have a far-reaching positive effect on nitrogen effect in the environment.
And that's dairy cows.
Great, yeah. Mm.
Do you, where you winter graze, are you near waterways?
Yes, we do, yes.
Have you managed the, any discharge or runoff or?
Yep, so we used to do, I'm trying to keep off the slopes now, but some of the slopes we gently graze down from the top to bottom, and then we try to keep the crop away from the, from the, from the waterways, and if we do, we try and graze those parts last so they have a less effect on. It's not, you know, you get a big downfall pour and it doesn't always work in your favour, and it's unfortunate, but yeah, those are the ways we do, try and do that.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, thank you for your presentation. Having done your farm focus management plans, has it changed in any way, minor or significantly, about your approach to how you run your property?
Yeah, it has, as far as I've just, I guess,
yeah, when you gave that one example.
Yeah. I guess it's given me confidence that a lot of what we're doing is actually having a positive effect, and also pointing out the things that I didn't know about that maybe I could do. One thing I have learnt is that a lot of area that we have developed in the past that was marginal area actually has a very insignificant economic effect on your, in fact, it has a negative effect sometimes trying to cultivate or develop areas that are very marginal anyway, because you get a very small return for a lot of money spent. And so, and those tend to be a lot of areas where it actually has a negative impact on the environment. So that would be one thing that he probably helped to point out again to me.
Okay,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on the farm plan, do you go back and update it? Is it a live document, or is it something just sit on the shelf and it's nice to know, feel quite happy, and I'll look at it sometime in the future?
No, I do go back to it. A lot of, for on our dairy farm, a lot of what he, there actually wasn't very, there's very few things to improve on, which delighted me. But on our runoff, however, there's lots of things to go forth. There's a few things I haven't gone forth with because the lease is due to be renewed, and we're looking at a possible purchase, and how, if that happened, then I guess we'd be investing capital and just trying to make that happen.
So is that plan a live document as far as you're concerned?
I believe it is. Yes, it is. In my mind, it is.
Okay. I'd just like to move on to the how you feed your crop. So could you just, for this year on your fodder bee, could you just explain very briefly what you actually do on for that fodder bee feeding, whether it's strip or blocked or portable drives or back fence, could you?
Yeah, actually, it was yourself, Lord, that spoke a number of years ago that got me back fencing. So I do that.
Oh,
after our soil structure. we do long strips, so I guess it's about utilising crop. And so it's the longer the break and the narrow it is, the more utilisation we get. And when you're doing that, I guess, it is a bit harder to back fence, but we have portable troughs where we can back fence. Wherever we can back fence, we do. And trying to look after that soil structure. The part about fodder beet I really dislike is that it's just a really intensive crop, because it's high volume crops, so you're on those areas for longer. And if the soil type is heavy, then you, particularly with tractors, make it a lot of mess, and you know, you protrude down to the clay, and I dislike it quite a bit, actually.
So just taking a little bit further, mob sizes?
Between 80 to 100.
And balage, silage,
balage,
or balage?
And a bit of straw, but we're tending more balage.
And just going back to the cropping one, there's been quite a comment about the 20 and 50 hectares, but listening to you today and some of the other things you're doing, you may only have, let's say, 50 hectares of either fodder crop of some description, chow, fodder beans or swedes. But there could be more activity on that farm as far as you feed off the cereal crop and grass as well. So in actual fact, you could be actually doing more area and cultivation than just the fodder crops.
Yeah, okay, so the idea with that new system, which there's a few people in the south doing it, is actually to more stitch up those areas that get plugged during the winter, rather than doing a whole cultivation. So you're not really turning soil over substantially, you're just sort of ticking it up and re-sowing. From what I understand, we'll be probably doing maybe 10% of that whole area, which will be a larger area, because you're giving more area when you're feeding our silage onto grass. But the key part to it is that we're using Mawata as a grass, and that Mawata's predominantly still established and taking out that nitrogen, you know, now. So whereas even the oats, you couldn't sow it until September, and doesn't take out the nitrogen until it starts to establish. So I'm already absorbing some of that nitrogen.
So if I just take that a little bit further, the oats and grass effectively is eaten off, but it's still there, and at least 50, 60% of it is regrowing until sometimes you can do something with it later in the spring.
So we sowed oats, but we undersowed Mawata.
Yep.
Harvested it twice, and then the Mawata came through. Oats no longer there, yeah. And then, yeah, what you're saying is correct.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, and I have no further questions, but it's been a very helpful presentation.
Thank you. Cheers.
Okay, we're now going to adjourn for morning tea, and we'll reconvene at 10:20. Thanks.